Hello, and welcome to the audio edition of Beastly Business, the first in a series of animal behavior human-animal bond mysteries written and read by Myrna Milani. Chapter 4. After I returned home, I put the remainder of the samples in my lettuce crisper, which I then put in my refrigerator for safekeeping. After so securing the evidence, I went upstairs to my office, sat down at the computer, and composed and sent a brief professional request for assistance with a possible goat problem to Chandler McCarthy. Although I readily acknowledged that the probability of him helping me solve a goat problem approached that of finding a non-shedding husky or an honest politician, I opted for this tactic based on the fact that he and Raymond Midgley both were Wentworth fellows. The way I figure it, they must know each other, and politeness will compel McCarthy to refer me to the much more goat-friendly Midgley. I explained what I considered my rather brilliant plan to Elizabeth as her eyelids slowly sagged shut. I'll thank McCarthy for his help, and then casually bring up the subject of his knowledge of the criminal mind and many friends in the law enforcement community. Then I'll tactfully raise the subject of murder. While I sat there congratulating myself for this ingenious scheme, the new mail icon appeared on my screen. "How can I have new mail, you idiot? I just turned you on 2 minutes ago, and I didn't have any new mail then." I also occasionally talk to my computer, with which I have a love-hate relationship. Although it's a must in my work, I'm also convinced it possesses a devious mind as well as huge hairy hands, just waiting for a chance to choke the life out of me for committing the most minor cyber error. The icon kept blinking arrogantly, and when I caught up the mail, sure enough, a message awaited me. From C. McCarthy at Hanover.edu. I chuckled to the dogs. Guess he doesn't have much to do. Well, I didn't either at that moment, so I caught up McCarthy's message and read, "What's the possible goat problem?" I stared at the message, which did not say, "Sorry, I don't know anything about goats. Try Ray Midgley at rmidgley@hanover.edu, as expected. Could I be so lucky that Chandler McCarthy knew something about goats as well as the criminal mind? My fingers flew over the keyboard. "Do you know any reason why someone would feed a goat microscopic pieces of multicolored plastic?" I'd just begun to rub Elizabeth's tummy with my bare foot when the new mail icon flashed again. I called up McCarthy's reply. "You and I must talk. In person. Soon. Where do you live?" My foot froze mid-sweep. This wasn't at all how I intended my first encounter with Chandler McCarthy to go. True, I did want to talk to him about goats in general and, at some point when I felt I could trust him, tell him about Monica and Harley. But this message sounded way too demanding and urgent. When I asked myself why he might feel that way, the idea that the sometimes biomedical consultant's interest in goats might specifically include my dead client's goat suddenly occurred to me. When it did, I panicked and hit the power button. As I sat staring at the empty screen, I knew I had to contact McCarthy again before he showed up on my doorstep. Considering I was the only veterinarian named Sinclair Upton in the country, and Hanover College lay a scant 35 miles north of my home, it wouldn't seem to require the brains of a Peruvian guinea pig, let alone a Peruvian guinea pig with links to the law enforcement and intelligence communities, to find me. But how do I know I can trust him? I asked the pets, whose worried expressions perfectly reflected my own mood. For a few equally worrisome moments, I told myself I didn't know, but also that I had no alternative if I wanted to find out who killed Monica. However, the idea of telling McCarthy everything and turning all of my samples over to him bothered me. A lot. No way would I do that. Instead, I yanked open the file drawer containing handouts from all the seminars I'd attended that year, then flipped through them impatiently while Maddie sat on top of the file cabinet and batted the pages, one of his more annoying feline habits. Finally, I found what I wanted, the notes from an endangered species seminar. While the cat explored the remaining contents of the drawer, I located the address of Jim Godfrey, the wildlife forensic expert who spoke at the meeting. He and I had exchanged a few articles and friendly shop talk via email since then, and his lab on the West Coast seemed like the perfect place for at least some of the samples in my fridge. I then sat back down at the computer, determined to compose this request more carefully than my last one. After much thought, I wrote Jim that I was sending him some samples about which I needed to know everything he could tell me. I signed it and shot it into the void, convinced he'd go berserk when he read the uninformative text, but not wanting to say anything that might get him, or me, in trouble. By the time I finished, the new mail icon had flashed 3 more times. I ignored it all 3 times and fired off a final message to cmccarthy@hanover.edu. Sorry, having power problems. We'll meet you at the faculty reception tomorrow afternoon. I retreated downstairs where I carefully divided my specimens in half, put half back in the refrigerator, and returned to Tony's clinic with the remainder. There I borrowed a styrofoam mailer and ice pack, carefully packed the samples, and arranged for FedEx to pick them up later that afternoon. By then I felt so wound up with nervous energy, I stopped at home just long enough to fix myself a cheese sandwich. Then I drove back to the cottage to get the bloodstained rug I'd forgotten in the excitement of collecting my evidence. Once there, I folded the rug and put it into the large plastic bag I'd brought along specifically for that purpose. Then went to take one last look in the laundry room to see if I'd overlooked anything. Evidently, I had. The instant I entered the room, a skull vibrating blow from behind sent me reeling toward the floor, still clutching the plastic bag. I plunged downward with only one thought in my head. Shit, I'm going to hit the corner of the washer. And sure enough, I did. The sun had long set and my head pounded so ferociously when I regained consciousness, I seriously considered bashing myself against the washer so I could pass out again. However, then I noticed that my left arm hurt too, and that took my mind off my head long enough to pull myself into an upright position. Once I accomplished that, it seemed like a good idea to get out of there. Go home and eat some frozen yogurt and cookies. I vaguely remember ordering myself as I tossed the bag containing the rug into the trunk of the car. Later, I wondered how many innocent animals and humans I inadvertently flattened during the drive home because I couldn't remember making it. I do remember the throbbing pain in my head and the motion of the car combining to make me sick to my stomach. And I also remember lurching into the house, unfortunately thinking about the frozen yogurt and cookies again, and barely making it into the downstairs bathroom before I threw up. Sometime later, the idea that something was wrong emerged between the waves of pain and nausea that rolled over me as I sat in the dark on the bathroom floor with my hot head resting on the cool edge of the toilet bowl. With a great deal of concentration, I managed to further define the problem. Where are the dogs? Why is it so quiet? When I focused my fuzzy thoughts more on my surroundings, I realized that sound, or rather two specific sounds, and not the silence, had drawn my attention. I could hear the dogs whining, but I couldn't pinpoint their location. But for as much as that alarmed me, another far more chilling awareness caused my stomach to churn even more. An almost imperceptible squeak of the pine plank flooring periodically punctuated the muffled canine chorus. He followed me. I struggled to stand, frantically trying to summon the image of some bathroom accessory that could double as a weapon. Another board squeaked. This one just down the hall. My legs turned to jelly and I grabbed the toilet tank for support. Another soft squeak made me spin toward the door, a sudden movement that gave rise to such a surge of nausea that my knees buckled and I sagged to the floor again. A formless shape materialized in the darkened doorway. I tried to scream, but a wave of dizziness swept over me, instantly followed by another of impenetrable blackness. When I awoke on the couch with the sun streaming in the windows, and Elizabeth, Teresa, and Maddie wedged around me, at first I thought I was dreaming. I hadn't slept on the couch since that endless week after Bob died. What was I doing there now? But then Elizabeth licked my nose, Mattie purred in my ear, and Teresa let out these pathetic moans she evidently believes communicate that she'll die any minute if someone doesn't feed her immediately. That someone would be me. I couldn't imagine wasting a good dream on something as mundane as that. On the other hand, I couldn't imagine dragging the comforter from my upstairs bedroom down to the couch, or putting a glass of water and a bottle of extra-strength Tylenol on the table beside the couch either. When I tossed off the comforter, I discovered that someone also had neatly rolled up the left sleeve of my denim shirt and bandaged my forearm. When I removed the bandage, I saw a cut so small it hardly warranted any covering at all, a revelation that left me feeling more confused than ever. I studied the cut on my arm while gently massaging the throbbing lump on my head with my right hand. Who had bandaged my arm? When no one answered, I groaned and rolled into a sitting position in an attempt to get my sluggish body and mind working again. But just about the time I thought I could summon the wherewithal to respond to my furry companion's increasingly insistent demands for food, a horrible thought occurred to me. The samples. With a surprising amount of energy and coordination considering everything, I stumbled into the kitchen and yanked open the refrigerator, then the vegetable bin. The bastard had stolen my crisper. My numb mind continued to recycle that phrase until I noticed Elizabeth licking a jar of mustard and Mattie grazing the vegetables. I yelled at the dog, started to shut the fridge, remembered the cat, dragged him out, and closed the door. Then I fed the pets and went outside with them in an effort to clear my head. The cool, early morning air slowly worked its magic, and soon my brain began working again. By the time the dogs had completed their morning rituals, I knew what I had to do. I was too old and peace-loving to mess with head-bashers and arm-slicers, particularly when armed with nothing more lethal than a toilet bowl brush. Therefore, I'd forget all about Monica Sonko and Harley, and fine-tune my approaching seminar for a group of human healthcare professionals. Mattie gave me a look I knew translated. Are you nuts? You're just a cat. What do you know? I told him rather than admit how frightened I was. Better to nail down my professional credibility while I can. While the cat dismissed that stellar, if somewhat irrational, idea in favor of stalking some poor defenseless rodent, it sustained me until I entered the office and saw the computer. As soon as I turned it on, I saw the new mail icon leering at me. 4 entries from cmccarthy@hanover.edu greeted me. I took a deep breath and held it as I read the messages, beginning with the one McCarthy evidently sent right after I turned him off. What happened? Then, talk to me. Then, talk to me, damn it. Obviously, the man was not pleased with me. Considering I needed his help more than ever now, it didn't seem like a good sign. Then I read the final entry and slowly let out my breath. I'll see you at the reception. You've been listening to an excerpt from Beastly Business, an animal behavior and human-animal bond mystery written by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, books on animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavioral and bond sites, check out my website at mm@mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the book Beastly Business in any form are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music in The Steppes of Central Asia by Alexander Bordin is used with permission of Katova Arts, www.katova.com.